books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we're joined by Lisa Timoney, Kate Storey, and Naomi Williams, who are all the same person. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. All coming up on today's Read On. Lisa Timoney is a best-selling multi-genre author who writes emotional family dramas under her own name, uplifting book club fiction as Kate's Story, and twisting psychological thrillers as Naomi Williams. The latest Kate's Story book about books is called The Last Page Cafe, and it's read by Louise Barrett.
Erin thanked the last customers of the day and followed them to the door. They smiled and nodded in reply, but their eyes were already on the heath and the church beyond. Erin didn't blame them. She knew that to most of the tourists visiting Blackheath, she was essentially part of the furniture of the Bookmark Cafe, grey in comparison to the technicolour world outside. Beyond the safe walls of her little domain, adventures awaited. For other people, at least. She was more comfortable in familiar surroundings, where life was predictable and there were no unwelcome surprises. She spun the sign, which had been hanging on the door since her mother opened the Bookmark almost 40 years ago. The side that said open now faced into the room. That always amused Erin. When the cafe was closed to other people, it was open to her. It felt fitting, since this room was her sanctuary. Allowing her eyes to travel across the cafe, as she always did at the end of a long day on her feet, she assessed how long it would take her to clear up before she could relax. Now she was in her mid-50s. Her legs ached more than they did a decade ago when she took over the cafe. She hadn't changed the decor in all that time. Why would she? Her mother had wonderful, if a little bohemian, taste. A hodgepodge collection of prints they'd picked up over the years hung randomly on the white-painted exposed brickwork. Each picture had a coffee theme, and Erin could remember where and when they'd come across each one. Her favourite, a woman relaxing on a striped beanbag, holding a mug, a book obscuring her face, hung over the fireplace.
The Last Page Cafe is an uplifting book. It's about Erin McCrae, who feels like she's living in the margins of her own story. Her son's about to fly the nest. The rent on the cafe that she runs is going up. So she's very worried about her financial situation. But she has this wonderful escape in the book club that she founded 10 years ago. But that book club has one very unusual rule. They choose the next book based solely on the last page, because Erin thinks that if the last page is satisfying, then the rest of the story will be worth it. But as things go on, long buried secrets surface, old wounds start to heal, and there's even a little bit of romance in this one. This is my first go at writing a romance, so I hope it hits the mark.
She let her gaze drop to the six brown leather armchairs around the low pewter-topped tables. The seats were saggy, the leather faded and marked, but she liked to think that gave them character. The plump cushions in various sizes added a pop of colour, as did what she called Kiddies' Corner, where a collection of plastic toys were scattered on a wipe-clean laminate square. She wanted the cafe to be a home from home for her regulars, and few homes were perfect. She preferred to see the cafe's imperfections as similar to the lines on an ageing face. Each had a story behind it. And stories were Erin's favourite thing, just like her mother before her.
No spoilers, but you know if a female character is annoyed at a male character, well...
Goodness. It's a well-trod trope, that one, but one that I think we find quite satisfying.
Now, this may or may not be related. It's not, no spoilers here at all. But we've got a journalist called Adam, and I think he speaks for all of us in his rejection of the way Erin chooses her books. He's quite against reading the last page first.
That's right. And he's not alone in that, actually. There's Susan in the book club as well. And she is furious about having to read the last page first. But because she's a very dear friend of Erin's and because she sort of respects her, she allows that to happen. But Adam comes in and he is a bit of a disruptor. He's saying, but why are you doing this? This doesn't make sense. And Erin thinks, well, do you know what? Off you go then. You don't have to be involved. But Adam isn't scared to try new things. And so he says, okay, we'll do it your way. And that's where things start to change in Erin's life, even though change is the thing that she fears most in the world.
Those old leather chairs were always the most popular seats in the cafe, not least because of the paperbacks she placed on the low tables in the centre at the start of each shift. She chose books from the wall of shelves at the far side of the cafe to suit her mood, often watching the faces of the people who picked them up, and stayed for longer than the time it took to finish their drinks. She liked to imagine them feeling the same things she did when she first read the pages. Sometimes she'd ask how they were finding it, allowing for a precious moment of connection in both their days. The cafe had been a little quieter recently. Passing trade had fallen off since Victoria decided to retire, closing the gift shop next door. The shop had been a treasure trove, packed with greetings cards, old-fashioned board games, trinkets, and brightly coloured cushions and homeware. It was where much of the decor of the bookmark had come from, since Erin's mother had found it hard to resist the odd piece of glassware or quirky candlestick. Victoria lived in a muse house a few doors along from her old shop, so at least she was still around, even if the road was noticeably less busy since the place closed.
Now, you're an author and you used to be an English teacher. Have you ever read the last page of a book first?
Oh, absolutely not. But I know a lot of people who have. In fact, the idea for this book came from a post that I saw on a Facebook book group. And somebody had said that they did read the last page first, and there was an absolute furore. But then it turned out that a lot of people said, yeah, I do. And actually, I spoke to my daughter, and she said, I always read the last page first. And it turns out, after doing a bit more digging, that it is very often an anxiety response. You want to know where something is going. If you are a little bit, if you're feeling quite anxious, you want the safety of knowing where the story is heading. And so when you look at it like that, rather than it being sacrilegious, it's actually something that I think we've got to accept and not judge. We've got to think about the whys. Most people's behaviour has got a significant motivation behind it. And when you look at the motivation and you understand the person, then hopefully you get a little bit less frustrated by their behaviour.
That's going to change the tone of the next question. I was going to say, have you written a whole book to tell people that they're wrong by doing this?
No, that wasn't the aim of this. But at the same time, it's not something that I would do. But I do try to understand why people do the things that they do, as long as they're not too heinous, obviously. If something's doing something really super terrible, then I suppose I would be a little bit more judgmental. But as I say, Erin is just, I love her. I love her. She's stuck in her life. She's scared of change. She's terribly anxious. And I wanted her life to improve. And the journey, Erin's journey in this, is hopefully managing her anxiety around change.
By reading the last page first, you're, like Stephen King will tell you what's going to happen at the end of the book, but he'll then explain how that happens, and you're not waiting to find out what happens, you're figuring out why it happens.
That's very true. I mean, a prologue, a lot of people don't like prologues. I love a prologue, because in the prologue you can quite often get a taster for whereabouts it's going to end up. But it's the journey that you're going through. So the prologue could be the ending, but it's how you get there. But because I write thrillers as well, I would absolutely discourage anybody from reading the last page first in one of my thrillers because that would ruin the book, I think, because I love trying to work it out. So different horses for courses, I suppose.
We've gotten to the thrillers and the family dramas in a moment, but sticking with your books about books, this is the third one you've written. You said you were writing it the last time we spoke, actually, but you described picking the books as beautiful agony. Now, what books did you pick for the Last Page Cafe and why?
Oh, that's a good question. So it starts with The Women by Kristin Hannah. That is such an extraordinary book. I don't know if you've read it, but it's about the Vietnam War and it's about the women's experience. And it's about friendship and sacrifice and just, it's just such a wonderful book, such a strong message of resilience and making your own way in the world. I absolutely love that one. So that's really significant in the book. And then because there are various characters who all choose their books for their own specific reasons, there are different ones. Very different ones. So I've got Love After Love by Ingrid Persaud. That's a beautiful book. And a character called Joe reads that when he's considering if perhaps he would feel okay about looking for love again after the death of his wife. He explores that there. We've got Captain Corelli's Mandolin in there. A character chooses that because she's trying to make herself brave enough to travel abroad and broaden her horizons. So all of the books that have been chosen are for very specific reasons. So I think I spoke to you before about how it's really hard to choose the books because not only do I need to know them and love them, they also have to serve the story.
A mewling sound made Erin turn and look down through the glass in the door. Tybalt, Victoria's grey tabby cat, stared up at her with imploring amber eyes, then tapped an impatient paw against the doorframe. Erin laughed and let him in, watching as he stalked towards the armchairs and bounced into one with an agility that belied his heavy frame. "Evening," she said. "Good day?" The cat ignored her and began to lick along the length of his fluffy tail. As soon as she sat down, she knew he would jump onto her lap, curl into a ball, and she would feel the vibration of his contented purr on her thighs through her jeans.
That's a clip of Louise Barrett reading from The Last Page Cafe. Now, how did you choose Louise?
It's a great process, actually, because what happens is the publisher sends me a number of different options. They come along with clips from other books that the narrator has already narrated. And so I get to listen and then I choose which one I think works best. And hopefully it's the same. I mean, we've never had a disagreement, actually, my publishers and I about narrators because they choose them because they think that the voice is right. It's lovely to be able to choose from a listener. You know what? That's exactly the right voice. And I think Louise has done an excellent job.
Do you listen to a lot of audiobooks yourself?
Oh, I am addicted. I listen to at least one a week. What happens is my reading time is taken up with reading advanced copies, proofs of other people's books. And so that's what I do when I'm physically reading. So, in order to keep up with things that I haven't been sent and that I really want to read, I listen to them on audio. And I've developed, I don't know, a sort of strategy. My brain seems to be able to do more than one thing at once, which I'm very grateful for. So if I'm driving, cooking, exercising, anything that doesn't take up too much brain power, I can listen to an audiobook at the same time and absorb it, I think. And I adore audiobooks. I absolutely adore them. Yeah, I don't know where I'd be without them, actually. They've enriched my life enormously.
And we'll have more from Lisa / Kate / Naomi after we take our first visit to the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. No Regret by Martina Cole and Jackie Rose was donated by Headline.
Margate, Kent. 7th of June, 1977. Margaret Riley climbed aboard a Leyland coach, decked out with bunting and photos of the Queen, and claimed a window seat near the front. Given the choice of a street party, or a trip to London to watch the parade, the residents of her little street in Margate had voted to hire a coach for the day. In holiday mood, despite a northerly blowing in off the sea, they waited patiently for their turn to board, cheering on a latecomer who'd had to chase his plastic Union Jack bowler hat halfway down the esplanade after the wind ripped it from his head.
"Bleedin' hell, it's Parky!"
Mavis Kirby, who lived next door but one to Margaret, hauled herself up the steep metal stairs and collapsed into the seat across the aisle.
"Good job I put me thermal knickers on. Let's hope it's warmer than this in London."
Margaret gave her a weak smile but didn't say anything. When she'd left London, 14 years ago, she'd been a different person, unrecognisable from the woman she was today. She hadn't set foot in the place since. She'd had no desire to try to reconnect with her past. Her focus had been on building a new life and forgetting the old one. But the memories were never far from the surface, and she was afraid the sight of those familiar streets would bring them flooding back.
Soho, 1962. When Rory Sheehan decides he wants Maggie Riley as his own, her fate is sealed. Luca Romano knows all too well that what Rory wants, Rory gets. And the violence that erupts between their rival gangs is just the start of it. Thomas Johnson owes Rory big time, and he must deny his feelings for Maggie to protect her. Faced with no alternative, Maggie throws herself on Rory's mercy, unaware of the brutality that she will face. But Maggie Riley is a survivor, and the secret she's hiding could be her best weapon.
Now she was wishing she'd resisted all efforts to persuade her and stayed at home today.
"Room for a little one?"
Shirley Green's voice cut through her thoughts. Without waiting for an answer, she squeezed her large frame into the seat next to Margaret and immediately began unpacking her striped nylon tote.
"I made these last night," she said,
pulling the lid off a Tupperware container and offering it to Margaret.
"Vol-au-vent, meat paste and egg."
Shirley's teenage daughter, hovering in the aisle beside her, cast a longing eye at the pastries.
"Can I sit with you, Mum?"
"No, you bleeding can't. Young'un's at the back,"
Shirley said firmly.
"Go on, give us grown-ups a bit of peace."
As her daughter rolled her eyes and skulked off down the aisle to join the other teenagers, Shirley held out the box.
"Quick," she said. "Grab one before that lot devours them all. Like bleeding gannets they are."
Queasy with nerves, Margaret declined.
"Thanks, Shirley. But I've got a bit of a bellyache." "Nothing a vol-au-vent won't cure,"
Shirley cackled, then proceeded to stuff a whole one in her mouth.
No Regret by Martina Cole and Jackie Rose is read by Annie Aldington and runs for 10 hours and 3 minutes.
Human Remains by Joe Callahan was given to us by Simon & Schuster.
Outside DCS Cat Frank's house, Coleshill, Warwickshire, 13th of April, 10:22 a.m. 3 months he's been watching DCS Cat Frank, and not once has she spotted him. He'd like to think it's because she's stupid, but to his cost, he knows she is not. No, her problem goes deeper. She only sees what she wants to see, so she doesn't see him at all. She likes to bend the facts to fit her so-called gut instinct, so that lies become truth, wrong becomes right, and the innocent are banged up as guilty. Right now, her gut must be telling her that she is safe. Because right now, she's yanking her front door shut with her raincoat half on, restricting the movement of both arms. And as she rifles for the keys in her bag, she fails to glance over at the parked car opposite. He grinds his hands together, one inside the other like pestle against mortar. He could grab her right now, trap her with her coat sleeves pulled tight at the waist and bundle her into the boot of his car. It would be over in a matter of seconds, but she owes him a lifetime. So he lets her climb into her car and drive off. He doesn't bother to follow, as it doesn't matter where she's going. Eventually, she will return. And when she does, he will be waiting.
The truth will always come out, but at what cost? Fresh from successfully closing their first live case, the Future Policing Unit are called in to investigate when a headless, handless body is found in a Warwickshire farm. But as they work to identify the victim and their killer, the discovery of a second body begins to spark fears that the Aston Strangler is back. And as the stakes rise for the team, so do the tensions brewing within it. When DCS Cat Frank is accused of putting the wrong man behind bars all those years ago, Aid Locke, the world's first AI detective, pursues the truth about what happened with relentless logic. But Cat is determined to keep the past buried, and when she becomes the target of a shadowy figure looking for revenge, Locke is torn between his evidence-based algorithms and the judgment of his partner, with explosive results.
The banks of the River Bourne, Shustoke, 10:56 a.m. DCS Cat Frank said goodbye to yet another pair of shoes as she squelched through the mud. When she'd offered to be the first responder, she'd assumed her wellies would be in the boot of her car. She'd forgotten they were in the back garden waiting to be cleaned, that John still wasn't there to do it. Their marriage had been a democratic affair. She had been queen of cooking and cleaning, he king of boots and bins. But as a widow, now she was in charge of absolutely everything, and some days the relentlessness of it, the unfairness of it all, exhausted her. She'd learned to brace herself for the raw grief that anniversaries provoked. The day that they first met, the day John was born, that monstrous day when he died. But moments like this still tripped her up, breaking her once strong stride. Her right foot disappeared into a bog, and Kat nearly lost her balance as she struggled to pull it back out. "How much further is it?" she demanded. Jim Walker, a bony-faced fisherman with grey hair and sad eyes, pointed towards the next bend, where the riverbank seemed to slump and slide even further into the water. "It's just over there." "Oh, of course it is," Kat muttered, although it was herself she was annoyed with. As a DCS, she wouldn't normally attend a call-out to so-called suspicious bones until an officer had confirmed there was at least some resemblance to a human corpse. But she'd heard the request on the radio, and because she lived just down the road in Coles Hill, she'd offered to pop up and take a quick look, even though it was a weekend. In fact, especially because it was a weekend. It was either that or tackle the garden or, joy of joys, clean the bathroom. At least this way, some other poor sod with an actual life wouldn't have their plans ruined.
Human Remains by Joe Callahan is read by Rose Aykroyd and runs for 9 hours and 44 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
If you have a question about sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is there for you. From using your mobile to being more mobile, from making celebrations accessible for all the family to simply making a cake, we're here to help. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or ask your Amazon smart speaker to call the RNIB helpline.
And now a return to my chat with Kate Story, or rather this time it's Lisa Timoney. We're chatting about The Lies Our Children Tell, a family drama that came out in January of this year and is read by Julie Maisie.
Nikki should have known something was seriously wrong before they got on the plane. The fact that Betsy didn't argue when her older sister took the window seat was another clue. Ordinarily, 11-year-old Betsy would dig her sharp elbows into Lola's ribs and make whiny complaints about how it wasn't fair, that Lola knew she liked to watch the clouds. Usually, she'd throw out some spiel about how just because Lola was 5 years older, it didn't mean she was in charge. Instead, Betsy watched in silence as Lola shuffled into the window seat and sat, pulling the hem of her jersey shorts down to cover more of her bare legs, tanned from a week in the Zante sunshine. Betsy then sat in the middle seat without comment, stealing quick glances at her sister as she tugged the belt around her waist, lifted the metal fastener and clicked it into place. This unusual compliance washed over Nikki. She was too busy stretching to reach into the overhead locker, shoving aside cases to make room for their backpacks. She groaned when she remembered the sugar-free lollipops she'd stowed in the side pocket of hers to stop her daughter's ears from popping on the ascent. She dragged the heavy bag back out, almost hitting herself in the face with it, and dropped it on the seat.
So The Lies Our Children Tell deals with two mothers who are very, very different. They were friends from university. They called Sabine and Nikki, and Sabine is quite outgoing and confident, and she is a very sort of laid-back parent. She says that her son Elias essentially brought himself up, you know, she's quite proud of this. And then we've got Nikki, who is a much more uptight character, and her parenting is quite helicopter. And when something happens between Sabine's son and Nikki's daughter, Nikki really, well, I'm scared I'm going to give you some spoilers. Things blow up, put it that way. And we are left watching the fallout of these two dear friends who are so very different, who have parented so differently. Can they survive what's happened? It's a family drama with secrets and lies.
A man with a sunburnt nose slid past her in the aisle. She tried to tuck herself in towards her seat, but still felt the man's groin brush against her bottom as he passed. He muttered, "Cheers," the smell of his beer breath wafting towards her. Unexpected tears pricked the corners of her eyes. She imagined Julian watching from where he'd always sat on flights to family holidays, across the aisle from Nikki and the girls, so he could relax with his fitness magazines and drink his whiskey in peace. He'd have said she gave the man the eye, encouraged him to push against her for the cheap thrill. That's what he'd said she did, teased but didn't deliver. She shoved the thought away. Julian wasn't here, and that was a good thing. Why did she have to keep reminding herself of that? It was as if the years of him telling her how good she had it had made it true, despite all the evidence to the contrary. The video that had changed everything replayed in her mind's eye. She pressed pause. She would like to press stop, better still to delete it altogether, but it seemed to be branded onto her brain with hot knives.
And see, now for this book, we're moving from Blackheath in London to Zante. Did you travel to Zante for this book?
I had been to Zante recently, so I didn't travel for the book. Budgets, I'm afraid, will not allow that kind of trip, unfortunately. But yes, I had been to Zante recently on holiday, and so that was very useful indeed.
Now, as you say, you wrote The Last Page Cafe under the name Kate's Story, books about books from someone called Story. But how did you decide on the names Lisa Timoney and Naomi Williams?
Lisa Timoney is my name. That was what I was first published under because my first family dramas came out as Lisa Timoney. And then my editor and I actually chose the name Kate's Story because we thought that nominative determinism was quite good fun with that one. But the name Naomi Williams, which I write my thrillers under, was actually my name before I was adopted. And so that was my first ever name. So that's why I chose that one.
Have you ever had a reader not realise they're reading the same author?
Yes, yes, very often actually. All of my social media is under Lisa Timoney /Kate Story/Naomi Williams because in agreement with my publishers, we thought it would be a bit too much to try and run three social medias consecutively. And so then I'll post something about one book and then another. And every so often a reader will say, no way, I've read both these. I had no idea they were both you. And that's quite good fun because they are such different styles. You know, one's very, very uplifting, one's full of secrets and lies. And then the thrillers are quite dark. Yeah, they're full of twists and they are no gags in those. No gags and no cats. Which we have a lot of gags and a lot of cats in the Kate story. None at all in the Naomi Williams.
Have you ever, I know at a book festival, though, people coming up with different copies of different books. Have you ever signed the wrong name in a book?
Ah, no, but I'm absolutely terrified of doing that. Absolutely terrified. And then it's really weird because if friends want you to sign their books, it always feels a bit silly to sign a friend's book. But if they want you to, I always say, well, what name do you want in it? Because, you know, they know me as one thing and then I'm writing something else. It always feels a bit strange signing books.
Now, let's move on to your thriller, The Eyewitness, which is out in a few weeks' time.
So The Eyewitness is about an ophthalmologist and she has a new patient called Rachel. Rachel wants to have a female ophthalmologist because of something that had happened in her past. And so Beth is dealing with Rachel and she has a condition where her eyes clamp shut for 2 days on and 2 days off. So she has these blepharospasms, which close her eyes for 2 days on and 2 days off. And Beth has to work out whether there is a medical reason for this or whether, which she suspects, it's more of a psychological reason. And she finds herself drawn into Rachel's world and she discovers that Rachel does have something that happened in her past. And so the problem is when Rachel's eyes are clamped closed, she feels like she's being watched. Soon, Beth feels like she's being watched as well. And so then the story plays out.
Now, we are on RNIB Connect Radio. So what was your research into blepharospasms?
Initially, I did some internet research. I then got my daughter to come with me to film my eye test. So I had an eye test at my local optician's, which is called Linklater and Warren. And thankfully, the optometrist was happy to talk me through all of the tests. So my daughter filmed it and she filmed all the equipment. And so I used all the information from that, but then I also obviously had to Google an awful lot. And the problem with researching a condition is that you can then be really tempted to put all of your research in because you spent lots of time doing it, but you can't because the reader wants to know that you're confident in what you know, but they don't necessarily want to be bored by everything that you've learned. So then what I did was I bought a children's book on optometry. And so I made sure that most of what I included was included in this children's book so that it was enough, but not too much. I mean, initially the idea came from a woman who did suffer from these blepharospasms. And it wasn't as specific as the timings that make mine fairly unique, I think, that condition. But they did, her eyes used to clamp shut for indeterminate amounts of time and then she could open them and they could not get to the bottom of it. And she ended up having 99% of the muscles around her eyes removed because of them clamping shut and she couldn't open them. So it does actually come from, the story grew from something that I'd actually read.
Is there a certain mindset you get when you go down to write these? Because, say, the last page cafe couldn't be more different from the woman in Ward 9. I mean, some are quite visceral thrillers, some are really cosy books. So is there a mindset? Do you have to be in a certain mood to write as a certain person?
My contracts don't allow me to wait for my movie. I just have to get on with it. It's interesting, really, because I feel like Wurzel Gummidge, that's a very old reference, but when I was a kid, Wurzel Gummidge used to take his head off and put it down and put a different head on. And that's what I feel like I'm doing when I'm writing. If I'm writing a Kate storybook, I can be whimsical and cheerful, and they still have a lot of emotion, but it is essentially uplifting. But it is a different mindset to write a thriller. But I'm not sure. I think I must have a really peculiar brain that can compartmentalize things, because I can do that shift. I've just finished writing the next Kate story book, and I will next week start writing a thriller. And it is a case of shifting mindset and shifting the sort of style. But I do that in my reading as well. I read very, very broadly, and I will read uplifting books and heartwarming books, and then I will read a really dark thriller that will scare the life out of me. And I don't know why, there is something weird in my head that allows me to shift, and I'm very grateful for it, because it's an incredible opportunity, really, to be able to move from one thing to another. It keeps everything fresh. I'm never getting bored of thinking, oh no, I've got to think of another twist and another twist and another twist. I can actually, you know, move from one to the other, and I would always write a full draft, so I couldn't stop and write something else in the afternoon, for example. I couldn't write one in the morning and one in the afternoon, but I can shift gear over the weekend, if that makes sense.
Has the new Kate story book got a title yet?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say, Robert. I don't know if I'm allowed to say.
Well, you've got to come on and tell us about it when it's out.
I would love to. I loved it. I loved it, because it's actually about an English teacher. I can tell you that. It's about an English teacher. And so I went back into the school I used to teach in for the day and spent the day with the teachers and the students. And it was lovely immersing myself back into that.
Do you think you'll ever be in danger of running out of books to write about?
Oh, I hope not. I hope not. There are going to be, I know there are going to be three more Kate stories, because I've signed that contract, and at least one more thriller. So I'm hoping they will keep going. And also, you know, the family dramas. I have a family. There will always be drama.
The Last Page Cafe by Kate Story came out a couple of weeks ago in print and in audio. The Lies Our Children Tell by Lisa Thorney came out in January of this year. And The Eyewitness by Naomi Williams will be out very soon. And all three authors rolled up in Lisa Thorney. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Robert.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
More from Lisa Timoney at the end of the show in Books of Your Life, but for now, let's return to the RNIB Library.
The Anniversary by Laura Marshall was donated by Hodder.
Travis sits in the front room, running his hands back and forth over his semi-automatic rifle, cool and smooth beneath his calloused fingers. He is calm. His heartbeat slow and even. In a few hours' time, 11 people will be dead. He can hear the gentle clink of crockery from the kitchen. Elaine is emptying the dishwasher, closing the cupboard doors softly so they don't bang. He had thought about killing her too, but he wants her to know what he has done. He wants her to understand why. That will be a worse punishment for her than death. Death. He hasn't thought much about it, although he's known all along it would be inevitable. He's not frightened, because he knows it will be a nothingness, like before he was born. If anything, he's looking forward to it. She made him fried eggs this morning without being asked. The edges brown and frilly, just how he likes them. He wonders if she senses that something is coming. She can be like that.
On the 15th of June 1994, Travis Green, husband, father, upstanding citizen, walked through the streets of Harstead and killed 11 of his neighbours. The last victim was little Cassie Coleman's father. As the 25th anniversary approaches, Cassie tries to forget the past, even as her mother struggles to remember it at all. And then something hidden in her mother's belongings suggests the murders were not as random as everyone believes. Cassie can't stop herself digging up the past, but someone will do anything to keep it buried.
Paul has left for school, and Travis is glad he's out of the way. He wouldn't want him to see anything. He'll be okay. Maybe in time he'll come to understand. Travis senses in him a certain quality, a quiet watchfulness that reminds Travis of himself. Last week, he caught Paul looking at him intently, almost as if he knew what Travis was planning. Their eyes locked for a moment, until Travis pulled his away and busied himself elsewhere. If he hadn't been so preoccupied with his plans, he might have been frightened. There are folk in this town who think Travis is a joke. He's seen them laughing behind their hands, talking about him when they think he's not looking, whispering this and that, swapping rumours about why he lost his caretaking job at the school. They certainly won't be laughing when this day is over. Some of them will never laugh again.
The Anniversary by Laura Marshall is read by Hattie Ladbury and runs for 10 hours and 49 minutes.
Wild Animal by Joel Dicker was given to us by Macleose Press.
It was a modern house, a large glass cube rising from the centre of an immaculate garden with a pool and a broad patio. The property was bordered by a sheltering wood, an oasis, a small, secret paradise, tucked away from the curious and only accessible by a private road. The occupants themselves were cut from the same exquisite cloth. Arpad and Sophie Braun were the ideal couple and the perfect parents of two beautiful children. That morning, Sophie woke at 6 on the dot. For weeks now, she had been waking up at the same time. By her side, her husband slept on, soundly and undisturbed. It was Sunday, and there was no reason to be up this early. She lay back down, but couldn't fall asleep. Finally, giving up, she got up quietly, slipped on a bathrobe, and went down to the kitchen to make herself some coffee. She would be 40 in a week. She had never been so beautiful.
On July the 2nd, 2022, two criminals set out to rob a jewellery store in Geneva. But even with their foolproof plan, their perfect heist will prove far from uneventful. 20 days earlier, on a luxurious estate along the shores of Lake Geneva, Sophie Braun prepares to celebrate her 40th birthday. Her life seems perfect. She's a fairy tale marriage, two perfect children, and lives in a stylish modern mansion surrounded by a lush forest. But her idyllic world is about to crumble. Her husband is becoming embroiled in petty schemes. Her neighbour, a policeman with a spotless reputation, is obsessed with her and spies on the most intimate moments of her life. Then, on her birthday, she receives a gift from a mysterious prowler that endangers her life. It will take many journeys into the past, far from Geneva, to unravel the origins of this diabolical plot, from which no one will emerge unscathed.
From the edge of the woods, one had a perfect view into the house's transparent interior. A man, his running gear blending into the darkness, crouched behind a tree trunk, his eyes fixed on Sophie. With her coffee in hand, Sophie rested her gaze where the forest met the edge of her garden. This was her morning ritual. She lovingly observed her tiny kingdom, unaware that she was being watched. A few miles away, in downtown Geneva, a grey Peugeot with French plates drove idly along a deserted avenue. In the early morning light, its driver could not be seen through the windshield. The vehicle drew the attention of a police car, its blue flashing lights illuminating the surrounding buildings. The police stopped the Peugeot and spoke to the driver. Everything was in order. One of the policemen asked the driver what he was doing in Geneva, A family visit, was all the explanation he gave. But it was enough to satisfy the officers, who shortly drove off. The driver, meanwhile, congratulated himself on the used car. He had paid a good price for it, and most importantly, it was legally registered. This was the best way to avoid unwanted attention.
Wild Animal by Joel Dicker is read by George Waitman and runs for 8 hours and 59 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And finally, on today's show, let's ask Lisa / Kate / Naomi for some book recommendations in Books of Your Life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Oh, I think I will probably go with Little Women. Oh, I loved Little Women so much. I wanted to be part of that family. I wanted to be Jo. And so, yes, let's go with Little Women because, oh, how I loved that book.
What in the world are you going to do now, Jo? Asked Meg one snowy afternoon as her sister came tramping through the hall in rubber boots, old sack and hood, with a broom in one hand and a shovel in the other.
"Going out for exercise," answered Jo, with a mischievous twinkle in her eyes.
"I should think two long walks this morning would have been enough. It's cold and dull out, and I advise you to stay warm and dry by the fire as I do," said Meg with a shiver.
"Never take advice. Can't keep still all day, and not being a pussycat, I don't like to doze by the fire. I like adventures, and I'm going to find some."
Meg went back to toast her feet and read Ivanhoe, and Jo began to dig paths with great energy. The snow was light, and with her broom she soon swept a path all round the garden for Beth to walk in when the sun came out and the invalid dolls needed air. Now the garden separated the Marches' house from that of Mr. Lawrence. Both stood in a suburb of the city, which was still country-like, with groves and lawns, large gardens and quiet streets. A low hedge parted the two estates. On one side was an old brown house, looking rather bare and shabby, robbed of the vines that in summer covered its walls and the flowers which then surrounded it. On the other side was a stately stone mansion, plainly betokening every sort of comfort and luxury, from the big coach house and well-kept grounds to the conservatory and the glimpses of lovely things one caught between the rich curtains. Yet it seemed a lonely, lifeless sort of house, for no children frolicked on the lawn, no motherly face ever smiled at the windows, and few people went in and out, except the old gentleman and his grandson. To Joe's lively fancy, this fine house seemed a kind of enchanted palace, full of splendors and delights which no one enjoyed. She had long wanted to behold these hidden glories and to know the Lawrence boy, who looked as if he would like to be known if he only knew how to begin. Since the party she had been more eager than ever and had planned many ways of making friends with him, but he had not been seen lately, and Jo began to think he had gone away, when she one day spied a brown face at an upper window looking wistfully down into their garden where Beth and Amy were snowballing one another. "That boy is suffering for society and fun," she said to herself. "His grandpa does not know what's good for him and keeps him shut up all alone. He needs a party of jolly boys to play with, or somebody young and lively. I've a great mind to go over and tell the old gentleman so." The idea amused Jo, who liked to do daring things and was always scandalizing Meg by her queer performances. The plan of going over was not forgotten, and when the snowy afternoon came, Jo resolved to try what could be done. She saw Mr. Lawrence drive off and then sallied out to dig her way down to the hedge, where she paused and took a survey. All quiet, curtains down at the lower windows, servants out of sight, and nothing human visible but a curly black head leaning on a thin hand at the upper window. "There he is," thought Jo. "Poor boy, all alone and sick this dismal day. It's a shame.
I'll toss up a snowball and make him look out, and then say a kind word to him.
Little Woman by Louisa May Alcott is available from RNIB Talking Books and read by Liza Ross.
Is there a book on a rainy day you can happily curl up with and reread?
I would tend to go with a poetry collection. I'm not a massive rereader, but Wendy Cope's Serious Concerns, it was out in the 90s, and she makes me laugh, she makes me smile, she makes everything feel better. I love Wendy Cope's poetry, so that's what I would go to for a comfort read.
Happiness Writes White. I am reliably informed that it was the French novelist Henri de Montholon who first made this statement, presumably in French. While I've been working on this anthology, I've come across a similar opinion in the work of several poets. Hans Magnus Enzensberger, in a poem entitled Joy, writes, "She does not want me to speak of her. She won't be put down on paper." English translation by Michael Hamburger. The late Gavin Ewart, a writer for whom I have the greatest respect, took the view that happiness is the one emotion a poem can't capture. And D.J. Enright, another poet whose work I admire, penned these lines. "The happiness you must take as read, the writing of it is so difficult." Difficult? But not impossible. There is one little poem by Enright in this book, and one by Gavin as well. Each of these writers may have been speaking just for himself, rather than making a generalisation about literature. But Happiness Writes White seems to be accepted as a self-evident and universal truth by a surprising number of other writers. I wish I had a pound for every time I've seen it quoted approvingly in a book review. I use the word surprising because one doesn't have to think very hard or be very widely read to see that it isn't always true. What is the best-known poem in the English language? Probably the one by Wordsworth, which ends, "And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils." And what is the feeling in those lines? Yes, some readers will say it is happy, but it is a thoroughly irritating poem, and I've hated it since my school days. I didn't like it either when I was at school, but I changed my mind, and I urge those readers to give it another chance. If you still think the poem we know as Daffodils is lousy, then read the other 100.
Wendy Cope's book, Serious Concerns, isn't in the RNIB library, but we do have her books, Family Values and The Orange and Other Poems, which are read by Wendy herself. And the one we've just heard from, Heaven on Earth, 101 Happy Poems, read by Rachel Atkins. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
I'm going to recommend a thriller by J.D. Wright. It's called After the Tide. And it's a really twisty thriller with real depth of character, but it's the emotions that make it very special. So a lot of thrillers are obviously dramatic and twisty and thought-provoking, but this one makes you feel a great deal as well. All of J.D. Wright's books really make you sort of emotionally connect with the characters, and they take you on a real journey. And the ending of that one, just gut punch after gut punch after gut punch. You end up sort of reeling at the end of it, but it's not one that you'll forget in a while.
Saturday brought sunshine, warmth. Andrew stared from the kitchen window. And as far as his eyes could see, the sky above was a uniform, strikingly blue canvas.
"Brekkie, kids!"
Sophie shouted upstairs.
"All right, Mum!"
Maria shouted back. Sophie was no longer Mummy, and Andrew no longer Daddy. Their little girl had trimmed their names long before any child should. 6 going on 16, they had said. Both parents missed it, though they'd never say it out loud. The difference 2 letters made was profound. It was just 1 syllable, but was yet another sign that their baby was growing up so much faster than they wanted her to. It wasn't a light pitter-patter of feet on the stairs that announced their imminent arrival, more a herd of elephants on the rampage. Maria barged through the kitchen door with Joe following close behind. Though they were just best friends, they may as well have been brother and sister. He was there often enough, after all. They wore wide smiles on sun-kissed cheeks. The innocence of youth abounded from every sinew, overflowing from every pore as they glowed with excitement. "All right, bud," Andrew said to Joe, their knuckles meeting in a fist bump. "Yeah, Ange," Joe replied. Ange. It was Joe's nickname for him, and Joe's alone. "Ready for it?" Andrew asked as he ruffled Joe's thick blonde hair. Joe might have been Maria's best friend, but the bond between man and boy was a powerful one. In the absence of a son of his and Sophie's own, Joe was a more than worthy void filler. Joe smiled and nodded until his head looked like it might separate from his shoulders.
After the Storm by G.D. Wright is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Elliot Fitzpatrick. I think Lisa made a portmanteau of that title, as the next book in the Beechbrook series from that author is called Against the Tide, which is out in June. And once again, Kate/Naomi/Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.